I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, today's guest is Jack Sullivan. He's a professor of biology at the University of Idaho. Peter, today we're talking about the ways of the chipmunk.
No, this is going to be fun because I think all of us who have gone out for hikes or used our public lands will see chipmunks and we'll go, aren't those cute little critters? And then that's as far
as
we go.
That's as far as you get it. Yep. So yeah. We're going to learn a whole lot about them and some of the genetics. First, though, I bet you got some nature news for us.
Right, Leif. We're going to talk about the tardigrade. The water bear. Moss piglet.
And they're teeny tiny things.
They're teeny, teeny tiny things.
Okay.
And, you know, they have survived all five recognized mass extinctions due basically to being the toughest critter in the universe.
Toughest critters, that's right.
In the universe, not just the world.
In the universe.
All right. They've survived after being completely dried out, frozen just above absolute zero.
Right.
They've even been heated to more than 150 degrees Celsius, which is over 300 degrees Fahrenheit, because Leif is Canadian. He knows
Thank
the
you.
Metric system.
Thank you.
Irradiated several thousand times more than us humans can withstand, and you know, they can survive the vacuum of outer space. How they do this, though, is through a protein that forms gels inside the cells and slows down life processes called biostasis. And according to research coming out of the University of Wyoming, we can take that protein and put it into human cells.
Get out.
And slow those processes down too, putting our cells into a very similar biostasis like the tardigrade.
I know some people like that.
Right, absolutely. Let's just shut down. But here's the even cooler part is that when you remove these stressors from these cells,
right,
they return to normal function.
That. Oh.
They return to normal function. Yeah.
I can see some applications.
There's a lot of applications.
Right. So if we're going to take a trip to Mars or something like that, maybe we want to go into a low metabolic rate so we can preserve ourselves or whatever for the trip.
Yeah. See, I just got done watching Alien and Aliens, and Sigourney Weaver's character goes into that cryogenic freeze. And so this could be the start of that as well. Yeah.
A trivia question today deals with chipmunks, of course. How many days a year does a female chipmunk mate? Well, when we come back from the break, Jack Sullivan's going to join us, and we're going to learn a lot about chipmunks, questions you never thought to ask. When we come back. Stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Jack Sullivan. He's a professor of biology at the University of Idaho. Thank you, first off, for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, Jack, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, so as you said, I'm a biology professor at U of I. I've been here since 1997. So pretty much my whole career as a faculty member, at least, has been here in Moscow. I teach things like mammalogy, the study of mammals, because I've been trained as a mammalogist, and I teach graduate courses in phylogenetics and evolution. So I have kind of a training in genetics, evolution, genomics, computational biology, things like that.
So we're going to talk about chipmunks today. How or why did you get involved with chipmunks?
Oh, it's a pretty funny story. I was a postdoc at the Smithsonian, and I had been hired here, and I was finishing my postdoc. So there was about an 18-month gap between when I got offered the job and when I was going to come. And during that time, I received a phone call from my soon-to-be chair saying that the Idaho EBSCOR program was developing a grant proposal on molecular evolution and ecology in Idaho, and would I like to write an abstract to be considered for this overarching research project? And that threw me in a panic because he told me he needed it. This was a Friday afternoon. He told me he needed it by Monday. So I was like, okay, what are the endemic species in Idaho that I can develop kind of molecular ecology, molecular evolution model systems? And chipmunks were an obvious one because we have a number of chipmunk species in Idaho. Some of them are endemic to Idaho or at least the inland northwest. Others of them are kind of more broadly distributed. So I threw together this kind of proposal, and from that proposal has stemmed 27 years and counting of research on chipmunk effects. So kind of a cool story.
That's great. The best ideas are born of need, right?
Yeah, panic-stricken sometimes.
Exactly. That's great. Well, we're going to talk about some heavy chipmunkery, but I want to start off with the least scientific question I can think of. Why are chipmunks so cute?
Well, the obvious answer is that we see them frequently, and that's because they're diurnal, they're active during the day, as opposed to many other equally cute small mammals, at least in my eyes, that are mostly nocturnal, so we just don't see them. Or we see them at night when we don't expect them and they surprise us. Lots of people see them in campgrounds or other places where they're out enjoying nature. They also have this really cool striped pattern. This is kind of a cryptic pattern that make them really charismatic, and they behave in cool and interesting ways.
I think for most of us, we encounter them, at the campsite, or maybe they're running around in the backyard, depending where you live. And they're burrowers, correct?
Yeah, there are burrowers, and some are tree nesters, but that's kind of some other cool aspects of their biology is that they have some variation.
Okay. What else do we know about chipmunks that live in Idaho? Give us a sense of what their life is like.
Well, if you look at the IF&G website, you'll see five species listed. And just last year, we wrote a paper with collaborators at the University of Montana describing a sixth species, the Craters chipmunk, Tamias cretaricus. It's this species that we knew that there was some kind of distinct entity there for a long time. We did a little bit of genetic data because it was classified as a yellow pine chipmunk, Tamias amenus, actually a subspecies of Tamias amenus. But its genetics didn't line it up with Tamias amenus at all. And so that caused us to look at the kind of original descriptions of that taxon. And there were some indications in the old school literature looking at the bacular morphology. The baculum is the penis bone. It turns out that that's an important taxonomic character for chipmunks, that this entity, this Craters of the Moon chipmunk, might not be a yellow pine chipmunk. So we had some indication that it was something different. And so we found those genetic types up at Seafoam Lakes. So here, back 20 years ago, we had evidence of this new thing at Craters and at much higher elevation up at Seafoam Lakes. So that kind of indicated that we needed to do a whole lot of field work to try and circumscribe the distribution of this new thing to see what was actually going on. And it turns out that it's a distinct species that's not actually most closely related to yellow pine chipmunks, Tamias amenus, which it was classified as, but it's actually more closely related to red-tailed chipmunks, Tamias rufocatus. So it's one of those kind of things that we call a cryptic species, some entity that we think we know about as part of one species that ends up, when we look at genetically, is an entirely distinct entity.
You know,
So that was a pretty cool thing.
which is awesome. And I think technology has really changed the game when we talk about species. I can remember way back when the definition that we kept getting honed in on was that, we have a species because it's either A, geographically isolated or can't produce viable offsprings with another species. With technology, that rule, I don't know if those still fit. And could you talk to us a little bit about species and what, beyond just difference in genetics, what really merits a species?
Sure, that kind of fits with the story because we were able to apply genetic data for large samples of individuals 20 to 25 years ago, 26 years ago, because we had technological advances that allowed really cheap and easy DNA sequencing. And so as we did this in chipmunks and lots of other people did this in other species, it was becoming very clear that what were ecologically and morphologically distinct entities were actually exchanging genes at a low rate, but at a high enough rate for us to be able to detect them in our sampling. So that kind of led to this realization that our classic understanding of the biological species concept, that is the largest populations that could potentially interbreed, that is reproductive isolation is the criterion, probably isn't that universally applicable because there is more hybridization in the wild than that classic definition would predict.
Right. So to try to wrap my mind around this, I know a species based on its appearance, right? And I'm basing that just on the coloration, maybe the size or some kind of physical attribute, or maybe even the location where I'm seeing them.
Yeah, the issue of what a species is, you know, probably an issue for a whole distinct topic of your podcast. There are hundreds and hundreds of species concepts that have been written, and we don't want to go down that rabbit hole. But the way I think about it is we have these independent evolutionary lineages, and the first type of data that we generally collect to make hypotheses about what those are things that you mentioned, things like coloration pattern, things like morphology, things like distributional gaps. And then those provide us hypotheses to test with genetic data to see how cohesive, how independent those lineages are. And it turns out that the large body of evidence that's been generated over the last couple of decades suggests that species can maintain cohesiveness and independence in spite of the fact that they occasionally, or maybe a little bit more frequently than occasionally, can exchange genes. And so there's a huge burgeoning research endeavor that attempts to look at the genomic architecture of, it's called introgression when one gene goes from one species into another, look at the genomic architecture of introgression and how species are nevertheless able to maintain independent lineages and cohesiveness in spite of the fact that genes can jump between species.
So let's bring this back to chipmunks. You're studying this kind of complexity, but you're using chipmunks as the model group to understand it. What makes chipmunks useful for doing work in this way?
Well, there are some things that make chipmunks an excellent model and some things about chipmunk biology that make them a little bit difficult to use as a system. But the things that attracted me is that their mating system is really well described, and it actually is a cool mating system called scramble competition. So when a female comes into estrus, she takes up a signaling station in her territory and starts waving her tail around. And that's always been interpreted as a visual signal that she's approaching estrus. There's probably pheromonal cues that are being wafted about as well. And males tend to leave their territories and start gathering around signaling females. And then when she comes into estrus, she'll adopt that same kind of signal, engage in that tail waving behavior, and then just take off. And it turns out that the fastest pursuing male gets a mating.
Huh.
Right? And then she'll do it again, and she'll do it again throughout her period of receptivity. So there'll be multiple matings per estrus in chipmunks. And really, there's now no mate choice other than the fastest male gets a mating. So it's not like they're focusing on calling behavior, specific mating for selecting mates of the same species. It's basically whoever's around and whichever one's fastest gets a mating. And so this is where their kind of reproductive morphology gets really interesting. I mentioned that they have a baculum, that's a penis bone, which is a really important taxonomic character for chipmunks. And it turns out that the baculum probably serves as a copulatory plug removal device. And so that the next male that mates removes the copulatory plug of the last male that mates. And so each female gets fertilized by multiple mates per mating bout. And so every individual or every brood is multiply sired.
Oh,
So they
wow.
have multiple paternity for sires. So that's the kind of system that tends to be leaky with respect to hybridization.
Right.
So that mating system makes chipmunks particularly susceptible to heterospecific mates.
So when we look at this, what would be like the territory size for males, and how often do some of these, say there's two species, how often does it overlap? And that's where you get the hybridization. At first,
Right.
coming into the interview, I'm thinking, well, their territory size probably isn't massive, and they probably don't move through this huge territory coming across multiple females.
No, they have relatively small territories. But one of the other things that drew me to chipmunks is related to your question, and that's that they're classic examples of niche partitioners. So, for example, if you go to the Eastern Sierras, where the ecotones are really sharply divided, elevationally, there'll be least chipmunks down in the sagebrush zone. There'll be yellow pine chipmunks, which we have in Idaho. In the next zone up, there'll be lodgepole chipmunks in the lodgepole zone, and there'll be alpine chipmunks at the highest zone. And if you remove, for example, if you remove yellow pine chipmunks from the bottom of their distribution elevationally, least chipmunks will move up. So they're this classic example where a species could occur in a broader range, but when there are other species present, their niches get restricted. So what that means for reproductive biology is that there are often at these ecotone boundaries, two species together, whose territories will overlap by a little bit. And then when territoriality is suspended during mating, then you get these heterospecific mating interactions at the ecotone boundaries, at the range boundaries. So lots of aspects of chipmunk biology make them susceptible to hybridization.
That's fascinating. Okay, so how do you study this?
Well, you go to where the boundaries are, you trap chipmunks, you identify them to their putative species based on the key taxonomic character, the bacular morphology, the shape of the penis bone. And then you sequence a bunch of DNA and you look for signs of gene flow. Do individuals from that you've trapped from well-separated portions of a species range form a genetically cohesive unit, or is there gene flow? And if there is gene flow, is it only at the boundaries, or do heterospecific genes travel into the interior of distributions from the edges of the distribution where the hybridization takes place? And so when we started, we sequenced mitochondrial DNA because that was kind of the easiest and cheapest to sequence. These days, we're doing whole genome sequencing so we can actually look for different regions of the genome that are more susceptible to introgress genes versus less susceptible to introgress genes. And that generates this whole new set of research questions.
And I'm assuming too, as with the niche examples, if you've got the two niches on the edge, on the bottom and the top, I'm assuming they would have less hybridization than those that are in the middle, because you've got those that are in the middle will have like two boundaries. And how much would that hybridization flow into the middle of a niche? Are you just finding it on the edges, or are you going to find it throughout the whole population?
So that's a great question. And it's only occasionally that we actually find what are called F1 hybrids that are actual hybrid individuals who have one parent from each of the species. Those are rare to find in nature. And when we find them, it's only right at the edge. But what happens, so if that were the end of it, then there wouldn't be any introgression, which means, again, genes from one species entering the other species. It'd be restricted to the boundaries. But those F1s, those first generation hybrids, will back cross to their parent species, and that'll bring some of the other species' genes into their some of their dad's species genes into their mom's species. So you get this back crossing back towards the center of the distribution. And so we can actually, there's actually a whole body of work called hybrid zones and Klein theory and how broad that area of hybridization is. And of course, there's lots of features of the genome that determine how far individual genes introgress from one species into another.
To date, have you seen any genes that are crossing through, or do they affect some of the morphological or, you know, coloration or aspects that you can see externally in the animal?
So that's one of the other things that I think is cool about chipmunks is they show a lot of intraspecific variation in their coat color, their pelage. They also show a lot of intraspecific variation in cranial measurements, or measurements of their skulls. So there's lots of axes of variation that aren't affected at all by introgression because they're presumably governed by environmental factors that vary a lot across, a broad species range. One of the really surprising things is that the bacular morphology never shows intermediates in the hybrids, at least that we've found. So the bacular might be shaped like a hockey stick in one species. It might be shaped like an even more curved hockey stick in another species. And in the hybrids, we find one or the other, but not an intermediate. So those are all the kind of genomic architecture questions that we're beginning to ask now that we can do whole genome sequencing across hybridizing entities.
This is really interesting. So to come kind of zoom back out, I'm trying to think about this over time, over larger spans of time, and I don't know how far back the methods that you're using can, you know, backcast the histories of chipmunks in the region. Can you speak to that at all? Like, how far back are you able to
Sure. We can make inferences of gene flow that go back millions of years, and the evolution of reproductive isolation sometimes takes a half a million years or a million years. And what's really kind of cool about these systems is that for the species that are kind of ecological specialists, glacial climatic fluctuations throughout the Pleistocene happened at a much faster scale. So we can hindcast species distributions based on species distribution models superimposed on paleoclimate models and make inferences that some species expanded their ranges and came into contact during, say, Pleistocene cold periods. And then during warm periods, they retracted their ranges and were isolated. And as you probably know as geologists, this occurred many, many times during the Pleistocene. So we have this recurring scenario where species come into contact and then their ranges retract and they become isolated. And then their ranges expand again during climatic fluctuations and they come back into contact. And the cool thing is that happens at a much smaller time scale than does the accumulation of reproductive isolation. So during evolution of, say, chipmunks in a particular group, you can have this complex history of contact and isolation, and you can sometimes see signatures of that in the genetic data that we've been able to collect.
It reminds me of, as I've moved through the zoo world, I've worked with polar bears, and they've come across a lot of genetic sampling where polar bears and brown bears have come in contact way more frequently than previously expected. So, I mean, that's exactly what you were just basically kind of describing, the history of brown bear and polar bear interactions.
Yeah. Right. And it's a phenomenon that basically affects anything that has species distributions that are tied to environmental variation, which is everything. Mm-hmm. Right. And so environmental fluctuations, climatic fluctuations happen at a much more frequent time scale than the accumulation of reproductive isolation. So this is, again, these are the kind of things that have emerged as we've been able to apply genetic and genomic data across a large sample of individuals from a species and large numbers of closely related species, as we keep seeing our old classical ideas about reproductive isolation being not being followed basically in nature, or at least not being really, really tightly followed in nature.
So let's come back to the Craters of the Moon chipmunk.
Yeah.
This is great. We have a new species.
Yeah.
Or new to us. I mean, it's already been there. We're just finally identifying it.
It's like discovering America, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And there were people there. The monks were there, and there were other monks there that knew about them, but we didn't.
Yeah.
Well, so they're doing well, and they're endemic. Is that
Yeah, they're endemic. They just occur in central and southern Idaho.
Yeah.
That's the only place on the planet you can find these chipmunks. They've been distinct for probably 1.5 million years or so, maybe a little bit less than that. They too do share genes on rare occasions with red-tailed chipmunks, kind of in the northeastern portion of the Craters chipmunks range. They overlap with red-tailed chipmunk range. And we do have some genomic data that suggests there may have been a little bit of hybridization there. But yeah, they're pretty much, like if you go out pretty much at across an elevational range in the mountains in central Idaho, that's the monk that you see. You mostly see Craters of the Moon, Craters chipmunks, Tamias cratericus. That was, again, until we started doing chipmunk research 25 years ago, was classified as a subspecies of yellow pine chipmunks.
That's our own chipmunk,
Idaho's own. That's awesome.
Yeah. And it turns out there's another one, not in Idaho. There's another example just like that with a subspecies of Tamias minimus, the least chipmunk, called the Cooley chipmunk in central Washington. So there's been some evidence that this little entity was something else. And again, some of our original mitochondrial DNA sequencing suggested that this wasn't closer related to least chipmunks. And so again, in the same paper that we described Craters chipmunks, we provide genomic evidence that the Cooley chipmunk is also its own genetic entity, although we didn't do the extensive field work to document that species range that we did for the Craters chipmunk.
That's
something that we need to do soon.
Yeah, I feel like we keep scratching the surface of the iceberg, understanding life in a broader sense, and as new technologies and advancements come along, old held dogmas kind of fall away.
For sure, and I guess to me another thing that's remarkable about this is, I mean, everybody sees chipmunks all the time, right? And these are not understudied regions,
right?
This is North America where we've studied biodiversity really intensively for a very long time, and we're still discovering new biological diversity that we didn't really know was there by applying genetic data. It's super cool.
That's great. It's really fun research. We started off with a trivia question that only a chipmunk would know, really.
Jack.
Or Jack.
Well, we call ourselves monkologists. Yeah.
I love it. How many days a year does a female chipmunk mate?
Well, chipmunks are monestrous, which means they have one reproductive cycle per year. Within that one reproductive cycle that chipmunks have a year, they're only receptive one day a year. So a female chipmunk mates one day a year.
Just remember, that's a lot of running for one day.
That's a lot of running.
That's great.
Awesome. Thank you, Jack, so much for joining us and really moving our perception of chipmunks being cool or cute to being very cool indeed. So for all of you who want to learn more about Jack's research in chipmunks, please just Google Jack Sullivan's lab at University of Idaho and enjoy. Thank you, Jack.
Thanks, Jack.
Well, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at Idaho State University with editing and production by Khalees Kendall and Jamin Anderson. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.